Hello and welcome to the 200th episode of the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 7th of December 2014. My name's TRP Watson and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Paul in London, Gareth James, Web Cowgirl and Phil from the West End Whingers. We're now going to talk about The Mikado, which is on at the Charing Cross Theatre. This is Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta, and it is being directed by Tom Sutherland, who's done an awful lot of stuff that we've been very complimentary about in the past. Paul, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Tom Sutherland is certainly a fan, I think, of people that contribute to this podcast, but also I think I've enjoyed his work, particularly The Titanic, which was at the Southwark Playhouse most recently. And I think The Mikado probably has to be one of Gilbert and Sullivan's most accessible operettas, perhaps, or it's one of those weird shows that is kind of an opera, but also it's also an early musical. And there's a lot of fun in it, you know, the princeling in disguise, the not quite innocent heroine, and it's almost like a pantomime as well, but it also could be a Cinderella. So it could be all sorts of things. And I guess the backdrop of The Mikado when it was originally written was that it was a way of providing a gentle dig to important people in society at that time, carefully concealed, of course, with the Japanese backdrop. And The Mikado, I guess, in the last 15 years has become quite well known, the making of it, thanks to the Topsy Turvy movie, which I think it was Mike Lee made, that sort of showed the creative process behind it, which in a sense created the first sort of production that had a director and also the inspiration behind it and all those sorts of things. But I think that all being said, it is quite a simple story in essence. And in this production, I think what sets it apart from others that I've seen is that the singing, for the most part, is at the forefront. And the sound is that the performers are actually unmiked. And there's some awfully fancy footwork with some excellent choreography undertaken. And they've also managed in certain songs, which I think they usually do, is to make, such as I've Got a Little List, make some very funny updates that I think go down quite well with the audience. The only problem with this production is that if you've seen other ones of it, and particularly the Jonathan Miller ENO production, which has been around since 1987, you may find that the updating to the 1920s gives it a bit of an unfortunate comparison. This production, it's set in a Japanese fan and umbrella factory, and while the singing is quite good, you kind of think that at times the production doesn't quite match up to what you're hearing. But I think after a while I ended up not getting too bothered by that and enjoying the show. I think Lee Coggins as Yum Yum has a particularly wonderful blend of pure soprano, and she has this quite girlish behavior that's not quite so innocent, but it's also quite charming to listen to. And Matthew Crowe as her suitor Nanki Poo, slightly underpowered, but he's is quite in comparison to Lee Coggins, but I think you'll find that he is quite charming to watch. It's quite funny seeing Hugh Osborne as the bank clerkish Coco as well. His little list, I think, is the first time when he gets a chance to take the house down, I think. And also finally, Rebecca Kane as the daughter-in-law elect Katisha certainly makes the most of quite a dramatically hammy role. And I think she, as this cougar-like woman that struts about the stage, she's quite amusing to watch just with her stares and her evil looks. So I think all, it's quite a charming little production that they've got at the Charing Cross Theatre. It's quite brisk for the most part, and there, as I said before, there is some excellent choreography and some even better fine unmiked singing that is quite something to behold. Whether or not it'll make you so excited by the production values is another matter, but this is definitely a show where music comes out on top.
What did you think about it, John?
First of all, I thought when I dialed back in, Paul's reading from his review, because it sounded as if he was reading aloud rather than just extemporizing. And then I realized he was reading from my review. You've not written yours yet.
Now I need to plagiarize yours.
So I am in more or less complete agreement.
I've taken the words right out of your mouth.
Yes, yeah, you took the words right off of my page. So I'm not sure what I can really add, because Paul's comments really are very close to what I put in my own review. And I think that Tom Sutherland, I really do like his work, and he is a master of the musical theatre genre. Parade was a triumph. Titanic was so inventive. And I think what he's done is made a slight mistake with Mikado, not in tackling it, because it could benefit from his ideas and touch, is in choosing the 1920s for the updating, because I think it just invites invidious comparisons with that hugely expensive, massive Jonathan Miller production that's been coming from the Coliseum for nearly 30 years now. Back in the days when Leslie Garrett could sing. Oh, no, I'm reading that. Sorry. Back in the days when Leslie Garrett could sing convincingly as a schoolgirl. I wish that he'd chosen some other time and place to reposition the story of Mikado. And I wondered, really, having seen Made in Dagenham, whether a kind of 1950s factory would have been, 60s factory would have been more fun than the 1920s one, where he just can't compete with the Coliseum. But wherever he positioned it, you need to do more to it than just announce a location with a set and have costumes of the period, because all we got in this production was the original story, the story of the court personalities and the population of the officialdom of the town of Titipu playing out exactly the Mikado story. So if you're going to transpose, I think you need to transpose more dramatically as well as just visually. And so the production slightly failed for me as a result. But as I'm sure Paul said, brilliantly clear singing and the comedy. I mean, the two comic numbers, I've Got a Little List and Punishment Fit the Crime, were topicalized and updated with the most stunningly clever invention and keeping very crisply to the meter of the original words. And I thought that was really worth the price of a ticket alone. And I do hope that they refresh that and keep it going, because this is, I think, quite a long run to sort of mid to late January. So, you know, if anything happens in the news, I'm sure that'll get built into those pieces. I only dialed in towards the end of what Paul was saying, but I'm not sure if he mentioned Mark Heneghan as the Mikado himself. Apart from the comedy gold that he manages to incorporate in the Punishment Fit the Crime, he's a really beautifully larger than life Mikado without being a pantomime character. He is a sort of, he looks a bit like Perón in Evita, you know, lots of medals on a formal naval uniform, and very grandiose and mellifluous in his speaking and singing, but also what he's saying and how he's saying it is very sarcastic and sardonic, and that's very nice balance. And he has a lovely, lovely singing voice. And you did mention Rebecca Kane as Katisha. Best thing I've ever seen her do. Really, really brought proper musical theatre to that part, whereas some of the other characters were more operatic. I mean, she has a very fine soprano voice, but she played it very much as a great musical theatre character. It made me wonder why her career has not had more big star roles in the West End, because, you know, 30 years ago she was first Cosette in Les Miserables and was very successful in that. And I know that she was one of the early understudies or standby Christine's in Phantom, and then went to her native Canada, where she did play Christine in Phantom in Toronto for about 10 years. But then she came back to the UK and somehow nobody picked up on her star quality, and she didn't get a lot of leads. And it's great to see her now as a more mature actress doing so fabulously as Katisha. And it's the same sort of career path, really, as her chum Francis Ruffel, who was, again, brilliant in the original of Les Miserables, and then had more of a career in, you know, one-night solo engagements and compilation evenings rather than another big-name part that you could attach her to. Anyway, the score has been adapted in this for two grand pianos, which I think looks lovely, but I don't think works. yes, it emphasizes the sort of chamber structure of the piece. I think when the lyrics actually say, and was it saying that the brass will clash and the trumpets bray as they cut a dash on their wedding day, and you think, oh yeah, well, it's doing that, but it's only doing it in my head and in the vocals. It really does need, you do miss a couple of other instruments in the pit. But, you know, I love the Mikado. I'm very happy to see this very charming chamber production at the Charing Cross Theatre, and it's very good value and it's very clear. You'll hear it. It's meticulously sung. But, you know, next time there's a revival at the Coliseum, I might just sneak back there too.
Just to add too on the point that we've made about the production, the thing that has struck me in the past when I've seen the Mikado, and it hasn't been updated well as authentically as it has to the 1920s in other productions that I've seen of it. I've not seen the E&O one, but I'm aware of it. I think the whole idea about setting the Mikado in a foreign land was to actually give a chance for Gilbert and Sullivan to be a bit more sharper in their focus on criticism of British institutions in the Victorian period. And somehow that gets lost. When you update it to the 20s, it starts to muddy some of that sharp observations. And some of those are actually still relevant to this day. And even the whole idea of the Victorian notion of the Far East, which was, you know, the ideas were picked up when there was a Japanese exhibition going on in Knightsbridge, which may or may not have been part of the inspiration for Gilbert to actually look at this piece. And I think you miss some of that when you start to also update the production. And that's, that's a shame. We can't see it as it would have been done in Victorian times. There always seems to be a tendency, oh, let's update it to the 40s, the 20s, the 60s, or whatever. But actually, perhaps it wouldn't be bad putting it in the period when it was originally intended.
I think it would transpose very well to Bollywood, where an Indian story about forbidden marriages or arranged marriages and the disastrous consequences that disobeying the formal rules about that can cause might work. I do think there are other locations. I also don't think that by the 1920s, our attitudes and knowledge of the Far East had improved very much. And I don't agree that, you know, I think our reading of what the, in inverted commas, Orientals were like had not changed very much from Victorian to Edwardian times. Because most.
The fashion's changed.
The fashion's changed. Yes. Well,
that's right. Was the drop skirt.
And everything looks better in a fringe skirt and spats. I don't know.
And hemlines that are higher, yeah.
Yeah, handkerchief hemlines and spats. That's what this musical's all about, isn't it?
We're now going to talk about Hope, which is on at the Royal Court. This is a play by Jack Thorne, directed by John Tiffany, and it has quite a good cast. We've got Sharon Duncan Brewster, we've got Stella Gonnett, we've got Paul Higgins, who I actually first saw at the Royal Court 25 years ago, I realised recently. Tom Georgeson, Nisha Nayar, Tommy Knight, Rudy Dharmalingam, Christine Entwistle, and Joe Eastwood. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, it's a play about the cuts, but it isn't a sort of angry, biting play about the cuts. It's rather sort of gentle and, frankly, a bit too slow play. It's set in a council where they have the dilemma of actually cutting their budgets because of government insistence, and they're struggling, but they eventually comply. And then there's an about turn when their consciences tell them they shouldn't, and they then decide to rebel. They have to live with the consequences of rebelling. And the whole story is really about the dilemma and how they have an impossible task, but also about the sort of the backdrop to that, the fact that the left has sort of lost all its fire and the right is imposing these things. And then we have the personal stories, in particular of the deputy leader, who's the man who turns, as it were, running through the whole thing. My problem is that I think the first half is achingly slow and the second half is a lot better. And I think it would have actually made a much better 90-minute play if they'd just run it without an interval and edited some of the first part, because for me it was just too slow. And Jack Thorne is a good writer, and there's a lot I liked about the play, and I'm particularly pleased the Royal Court is at last putting on a play of some relevance, because it had really been a very dud year at the Royal Court, and therefore in Royal Court terms this is quite refreshing, a bit of a breath of fresh air really, but against everybody else's standards it's still not good enough. Initially, I found the lack of bite to be the issue, but actually, as it progressed, I sort of thought, well, that isn't the point of the play. So I kind of did to sort of warm into it after a while. But it's still, I think, too long. They'd cut 50 minutes in preview, but it still probably could do with another 50 minutes, and I think probably an interval cut as well. Good performances, as you say. There's a particularly fine performance from a young lad called Tommy Knight, who plays the son of the deputy leader, who's now estranged. It was a terrific little performance. And very good to see Sharon Duncan Brewster on stage. I haven't seen her for a while, and she's also very good. And there's a sort of an old lefty in Tom Georgeson, and he really suits that role absolutely completely. So well-performed, nice design, you know, where they've created this huge cavernous 70s council hall, I suppose, with a stage, and the stage can kind of move back and forward to give you more intimate scenes. But a lot of the personal scenes are set in the hall, and they're a bit lost in that, really. So I think it's okay. I'm quite glad I went to see it, but it felt very much like unfinished work to me. And it certainly wasn't anything like as good as everything else John Tiffany's done in recent years. And he injects some of his sort of trademark movement, which is completely incongruous in this play. So as a piece of work by John Tiffany, I think a bit disappointing. As a piece of writing by Jack Thorne, a bit disappointing. Probably, though, something, you know, a sign of things getting better at the Royal Court, maybe. I don't regret going, but I wouldn't rave about it.
John, what do you think?
I like Jack Thorne's writing, and I thought it was pretty good in this piece, but as Gareth says, there was far too much of it. I was also a little bit braced before going to the Royal Court to see a play that I knew was going to be about government spending and the cuts and so on, to feel that I was going to be subjected to some kind of onslaught of Labour propaganda. But in fact, the play is far, far cleverer than that. And I did appreciate how even-handed it was, because yes, you do get the resistance of this Labour group of councillors to the imposition from Eric Pickles's government department of, I think they have to make 60 million savings over the next 3 years. And this is the first year they've got to find 20 or so. And yes, there's lots of railing against very easy targets of, you know, the austerity package that's handed down from government for local authorities to apply. But in the second act, there is an absolutely magnificent speech by Tom Georgeson as an old Labour working class man-made good diehard, a really impassioned speech where he blames the failure of all of this not on the Tory government, but on the Labour movement, which has failed to re-energise itself and to protest effectively and to behave as, for example, the population of, I don't know, France or Greece particularly did when similar cuts were imposed on them. I think he says, Greece is on fire with anger and action. And he blames people from the left for merely, I don't know, tweeting and Facebooking about things and tutting about it rather than actually mobilising and activating. I don't think it's any kind of a call to arms, and I don't expect to see, you know, acts of violence in Grosvenor Square. But it is really even-handed of Thorne, who obviously is not at all a right-leaning sympathiser, to include this bashing of the Labour movement and the Labour hierarchy. I enjoyed lots of the performances. I mean, Paul Higgins can do no wrong for me. I am so full of admiration for his work, both on stage and, of course, as the foul-mouthed Jamie, Malcolm Tucker's sidekick, in the thick of it. And I have a bit of a thing about him. I don't mean it like that, but, you know, sometimes there are actors who are so brilliant, and then they marry somebody else so brilliant, and you think, oh my God, I'd just like to be a guest at their dinner table. And his partner is Amelia Bullmore, who, you know, again, is an actress of tremendous range herself, but also a writer of great energy and very prolific. And I just think how wonderful it would be to know them both. And so some of my kind of appreciation of his work is the appreciation of you know, them as a fantastic theatrical couple as well. But there's great anguish and a sort of beautiful sympathy in his character as Mark. But there's also too easy a structure in the play. Mark's ex-wife, from whom he is estranged, is a social worker who runs a daycare centre, and her programme has to be a victim of the council budget savings. And that's too pat. I didn't like that. And there's also another thing that I think we should mention, in that there's a The play is introduced by a bit part, a small part actress coming on stage and just saying how everything is set. And she is an actress who has Down syndrome, Jo Eastwood, and she is very beautiful and very capable in herself. It is a lovely piece of work by her. But I think it's a rather clumsy and, I don't want to say inappropriate, but uncomfortable use of a Down syndrome actress as a kind of very tokenist image of what will suffer when cuts are applied, because that was a little bit too harsh and a little bit too crude in the politicising of the play. And I also think it would have been far more effective if her little narrative had been introduced later on rather than she'd been used as a curtain raiser.
Well, Johnny, she's been completely from the one that I saw. I mean, not her part, but that speech has been cut.
Yeah, I didn't get that speech at the beginning either. There is a part in the play where she talks, but she certainly doesn't do any prologue.
Okay, well, there was quite a big prologue, and it was almost as if she'd come on stage to quieten the audience for some kind of announcement that, you know, there was an understudy or something like that. So I appreciate that. I saw the last preview, so I'm slightly surprised that changes have been made between then and the first night, but okay. Yeah. Anyway, it's a piece that's in flux, and maybe I ought to go and see it again. But I definitely agree with Gareth. 90 minutes would make this a much more powerful play.
Yeah, I think that to make it a much more powerful play, they actually need to just completely run with the fantasy aspects of it, because it's I love how it starts out really sort of grounded in the horrible reality of how politics is conducted these days via Twitter and Facebook, and people getting outraged over some tiny slice of something that they're capable of understanding. But folks are completely incapable of seeing the picture, the big picture, and really going, this just isn't right. And what Greece is doing does seem, or what they have done, does seem like an appropriate level of outrage, but it's, you know, it's simply not being achieved here. I think part of the reason is because, in particular, the media has done a good job of getting people to demonize each other instead of seeing that it's actually the government that's even making it necessary for people to figure out, oh, do I shop out my neighbor for, as they said, £10 of benefit fraud? I saw some numbers recently saying that something like 80% of the people, or 60% of the people, like probably 80, receiving benefits are actually employed people who are receiving benefits because they simply don't make enough. And after, you know, this many years of people not even receiving inflationary rises, while their gas and their food bills and their transportation bills have continued to skyrocket, it's no wonder people simply can't make it stretch enough. And yet somehow the discussion has been, oh, we need to get those benefits tourists under control, and all sorts of money being spent on ridiculous things so that, you know, if God forbid some foreigner injured themselves while they were in the UK, well, we'd absolutely want to make sure we got all the money that they owed us for going to the hospital for, you know, for a broken leg or something like that. But that's not what the real criminal action is. It's what the government is doing and seeming to really get away with. So when the counselor proposes that they do this absolutely crazy, wild stunt to really make it all stand out, frankly, what he actually chose to do was really boring. It was completely in the realm of sort of reality. A simple refusal, and the consequences for it were, in theatrical terms, really very dull. And I wish that they had just done something, a fantabulous, wild stunt, sort of like the stunt that the woman pulled to try to save the daycare center for the disabled. I mean, of course, that wasn't like that wasn't like out of the realms of reality. But so I found this play disappointing, It said it was sort of funny, but it actually wasn't funny enough. It did have good performances in it, but ultimately it was just sort of disposable. You know, I saw it, it happened, and I'm probably not going to think about it again for the rest of my life, which is unfortunate because I do want to see theater engaging really actively with the life that we're living now. I want new plays to be written that talk about the situation that we're living in, the political situation, the economic situation, and I don't want them to be boring, dull plays. Like Great Britain was an excellent example of somebody writing a play that was just absolutely engaged with what's going on right now. And I'd like to see more of that because that's actually, it seems, one of the really great British ways of protesting the kind of stuff that is being lobbed off on us is simply unavoidable. And I think that theater is a way that we can change the discussion about what's possible and to go off into fantasies and to really just have a good time with it. And it's a way of getting people to think about things that I think is much less didactic than reading some columnists or what have you. So I'm glad that I went and saw Hope. Even if they do a 90-minute version of it, there's no chance that I'd ever go back.
We're now going to talk about Assassins at the Menier Chocolate Factory. This is Stephen Sondheim's musical about, well, the people who have tried to assassinate American presidents. It's got quite a cast. Some of the people who jump out at me, and hopefully other people will be mentioned, but people like Mike McShane, Simon Lipkin, Catherine Tate, Andy Nyman, and Jamie Parker. I think there are other people to mention. Web Cowgirl, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
I was completely unfamiliar with this play other than it being a Sondheim musical about assassins. And the whole experience was just tremendously exciting. It was really such a good production, and I think it's the hottest ticket out there right now. The Menier is transformed from the minute you walk into the little, down the little stairs, taking you into the area of where the theater is. You are suddenly transformed into a very dark and scary circus, a sort of a sideshow where this gaping maw with pointy teeth is waiting for you to step in. And as an audience member, this sort of changes your experience of, you know, you're not entirely just sitting down and watching a play. You are a part of the action, which is like a very, very uncomfortable thing. The various assassins are introduced to us, the audience, and they are magnificently crazy people. And I really am only familiar with three of the most famous assassins or would-be assassins: John Wilkes Booth, Lee Harvey Oswald, and John Hinckley, who attempted famously to assassinate President Reagan in the 80s and became responsible for the birth of a punk rock band called Jodie Foster's Army, which I remember with fondness from my youth. But as they sit there waving around their guns and cheering each other on, you can't help but feel like they almost represent a society that has just come sick in the soul. And you're actually encouraging the existence of these people by wanting to watch them talk about and explain why they think that the best possible thing that they could do in their lives would be to shoot a president. And as the gunplay begins and the sort of master of ceremonies slash evil clown lights up signs saying, I think it was hit or miss, in bright sparkly light bulbs, the whole thing just seems absolutely terrifying and revolting and yet so fascinating. The songs have the typical Sondheim, not very melodic, you know, you don't walk out singing anything to yourself. But overall, as a spectacle, as a theatrical experience, I thought Assassins was just fantastic. What about you, Gareth?
Well, I go back 22 years with the show because I was at the British premiere of what was the second version of the show in 1992 at the Donmar. And since then, I've seen a production at the Union maybe about 4 years ago and a production at the Landor a bit further back than that. For me, this is probably the most audacious of all musicals. And I think what's great about this is it gets the most audacious of productions. And it is... It's not an evening that you can say is entirely comfortable. It's certainly not safe, but it is very, very fascinating and very, very rewarding on all sorts of levels, really. The show can sometimes feel like a song cycle because effectively what you've got is you've got the assassin stepping out from the background or the chorus, if you like, and then telling their story and stepping back in again. But in this production actually does feel like more of a show. And I liked that. I like the idea of the sort of, I mean, it is meant to be set in a sort of fairground come shooting range, really. And the proprietor is an anchor to the piece, as is the balladeer. And the proprietor here is played by Simon Lipkin, and he's absolutely brilliant. He's got makeup, which is kind of referencing the American flag, and it's a very gothic kind of look. And the balladeer has been given a kind of 60s folky makeover, which, given Jamie Parker's other part, which I won't reveal, is wholly appropriate. And Jamie Parker is terrific in both of those roles. So that's sort of very good casting. He's recently done a terrific Sky Marston in Guys and Dolls of Chichester, and it's great to see him continue to give very good musical theatre performances. I think what this production did for me is it brought out a lot of psychological depth in the motivation of the assassins, and I found that very, very interesting indeed. Other performances, I was frankly worried about the casting of Catherine Tate, who for me has a tendency to sort of be a bit one note and play Catherine Tate all the time, but she did actually suit the role of a sort of somewhat loopy character that she's got, Sarah Jane Moore, who's one of the women who failed to assassinate Gerald Ford. But there's some other great work. Andy Nyman is really good as Gateau, who kills James Garfield, and he gives him a really sort of manic, unhinged feel. And also, I thought Aaron, either it was Tevitt or Tveit, is very fine as John Wilkes Booth, because I think he's a lot of presence. He's got a particularly fine voice. And another couple of good performances from Stuart Clark and David Roberts, who are Zangara and, I don't know how you pronounce his either, Glogotz, or is a sort of Polish character. And they also impress with particularly good characterizations. So I think this is a production for now, really, of assassins. I think it's kind of an assassins for our times. And I think it is an underrated show anyway, and I think it's great to kind of get a fresh look at it. And, you know, Jamie Lloyd can do no wrong for me, because he's just, you know, everything I've seen in the last few years, and I've seen a lot because of his season at the Trafalgar Studios and The Commitments and Urinetown. I mean, he, you know, he really is a terrific director and particularly good at sort of reinventing these musicals, really. So absolutely a must for anybody, but certainly a must for a Sondheim lover. But if you haven't got a ticket, I'm afraid as of Thursday, the entire run completely sold out. But if this doesn't transfer the West End, I'll be completely shocked. I think that's fairly inevitable, because it's the fastest ticket, I think, at the Menier, which has got a reputation for selling out fairly quickly. But this is sold quicker than anything else, I think, for them. And it's got more seats than it usually has because of the way it's staged. A great evening.
I have to say, if it's sold out and there's a few Christmas presents out there, you couldn't have a better gift than to discover that you've got a ticket to this show, because it really is, I think, just the best musical that's on right now.
Well, except it's not for all tastes, though, I don't think. I mean, we were three on Friday night, and one of the three really didn't like it at all. She just wasn't to her taste at all. And I think traditional music theatre lovers find it very difficult, because it kind of subverts the musical theatre form, and I like the fact it subverts the musical theatre form, but I don't think it's actually to everyone's taste, in all fairness.
I would expect that anybody who'd bought those tickets would, you know, probably have an idea that maybe they weren't buying a warm and cuddly show, but all I can say is if Santa gave me another pair, I'd be as happy as could be, because I especially would like to see it after Catherine Tate has left, because I think it will be interesting to see what happens if they get someone who's kind of not doing such a star turn in the show.
Yeah.
What did you think about it, Phil?
Well, I agree with those two. I really enjoyed it. I've seen it three times before. The first one at the Donmar was, I really liked it then, and I still like it. I do think it's a little bit of a scrappy show, but I think on the whole, Jamie Lloyd really pulls that together. There were a few moments where I thought, oh, hang on, I'm not quite sure of the full story of that, and but there's some quite good notes in the programme. And, you know, that fills in particularly with the, I can't remember his name now, but the character that Mike McShane plays, Samuel Bick, the guy that flew into the White House, or wanted to fly into the White House. I thought the cast were across the board excellent. I think Mike McShane did the sort of the monologue absolutely brilliantly, you know, real piece of good acting in it. And the singing was particularly good. I thought Aaron Tveit had a particularly strong voice. You can tell he's a leading man on Broadway. I really liked Jamie Parker as the balladeer. Not going to say too much more about his character, although you may have already given it away, but it's kind of a character that's conspicuous by his absence. I think he's got a kind of cheeky likability. He was always my favourite history boy anyway. And I think Catherine Tate and particularly Carly Borden as the two who are out to get Gerald Ford played the comedy well. Carly Borden sings terrifically as well. I really like her anyway. Andy Nyman was very good with the sort of going to the Lordy song. I can't remember the actual name of it, but he kind of really had some terrific energy. And actually, and I forgot to mention when I wrote the review, but Simon Limpkin is the rather spooky, and I noticed a lot of people in the critics' reviews have referred to him as a sort of jokerish kind of figure, which he sort of is, but he's very sinister. And it's all wrapped up beautifully in Sutra Gilmore's set, which, you know, you enter through a fair, sort of gaping fairground mouth, which really sets the kind of the tone. The lighting was very good, especially the way it was timed with the sound. There's really not much to criticise, although I will criticise this, staging it in the Traverse, which I never really liked the Traverse, although I think they made a pretty good job of that. It does have a few problems with sight lines occasionally. At the beginning, one of the not main characters comes on with a carousel and then places it on the floor, and you can't see the Meunier because heads are in the way, it's not raked enough. And there was a death that we missed for the same reason. But, you know, those are kind of very small things. I think it's a really well done piece. Despite all the sinister overtone of the thing, there's a lot of humour in there. And I think the style of the songs, although I don't think they're sometimes best score, but I think it's kind of a very varied score. And it's clever, you know, and it's clever and it's enjoyable.
Tim, just a word of congratulations on your 200th podcast. The rest of us, of course, have only been dipping in and out and have done nothing like 200, but you've done all 200. So I guess that must be 4 years or so. So congratulations on 200. I don't think there's a name for 200, is there? Double century. Congratulations on your double century.
Well, thank you very much. Yes.
And happy 200th. Interesting, you still haven't found a name for it, but I assume you're going to carry on like this now. So another 200 at least of the unnamed, yet unnamed theatre blog.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.